A new report out this morning shows the number of women who died of maternal causes in the United States rose in 2021, continuing a baffling trend. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called this change a sharp increase from the few years prior. The hike in maternal mortality includes different age groups and races, but during the next hour, we'll focus on deaths of African American women in particular, being three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes, especially as Cuyahoga County has one of the highest rates of maternal and infant mortality for Black women and babies. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. A documentary shows in Cleveland next week that looks at that particular statistic through the eyes of families who've lost women to childbirth complications in the past 3 years. They've initiated a crusade to at least bring the level of Black deaths in line with those of all women, despite the U.S.'s poor standing. We'll also look ahead to the Cleveland Humanities Festival, which this year is tackling the concept of wellness, intermittent fasting, to sleep, to waste reduction. It all starts after national and local news. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us, and happy Thursday to you. Each year, the Cleveland Humanities Festival examines one topic, an idea, a concept, from a wide variety of angles. Past topics have been nature, immigration, and truth. This year, at the center of the programming is the concept of wellness. Events at the festival include lectures about intermittent fasting, sleep, waste reduction, but organizers have also included events focusing on financial wellness, the mental health of teenagers, essential oils, and even poetry workshops. That goes to show you just how wide-ranging each year's interpretation of these topics can be. To kick off today's program, we'll discuss some of the events featured at this year's Cleveland Humanities Festival, which is organized by the Baker Nord Center for the Humanities at Case Western Reserve University. Later in the hour, we'll preview a free film screening and panel conversation hosted by MetroHealth and Creating Healthier Communities about the maternal and infant mortality crisis happening in Cuyahoga County and across the country, particularly hitting the African-American community hard, but impacting mothers of all races. And finally today, did you know Akron once had a neighborhood called Old Dublin? We'll look at the history of Akron's Irish enclave just ahead of St. Patrick's Day. But first up, we discuss wellness. With me to do that, Dr. Michelle Tracy Berger. She's director of the Baker Nord Center for the Humanities at Case Western Reserve University. Michelle, thanks for being with us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Great. Thank you. Also joining us, David Fukunle, who's one of the speakers at this year's festival, works in public health at Morgan State University, the University of Florida Center for Arts and Medicine, and the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you for being here as well.
Good morning. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And finally, also joining us, Rachel Dorsey. She is another of this year's speakers. Rachel's a financial wellness coach, be giving the lecture, How to Build a Healthy Financial Life. Rachel Dorsey, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
If listeners would like to join our conversation, there are several ways you can do that. Give us a call, 866-578-0903. You may email questions or comments, soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We are @SoundOfIdeas. Michelle, let me start off with, for those who aren't familiar with the Humanities Festival, explain for us in a nutshell what it looks like, how Case and the Baker Nord Center came to choose a topic like wellness.
Yes. Well, it starts with a process of coming together with our community partners. We have over 30 community partners working with us for this year's Humanities Festival. And we start the summer before where we have a conversation about social issues, important trends and topics, intellectual discourse, and kind of what will resonate across our community. So after that process, we kind of brainstorm, we think about a little bit more, and then we come together and really decide to move forward with a topic. And wellness seemed to be such a powerful one, given where we are coming out of the pandemic. And we really started, I really started with this idea of thinking about wellness, the physical body, right? What happens to our bodies through, you know, issues around health and wellness, but also this idea of the social body, the idea of race, class, gender, and how we move through the world and how that impacts this idea of health and wellness. And then I think it's been broadened out to really thinking about wellness and flourishing, the individual body and the social body and the collective body. And what does that mean living in this democracy?
I think one of the interesting aspects of the festival is how the key work or the concept here can be interpreted. What was your initial thought when you talked about wellness? You were just explaining how it continues beyond the physical into the mental, but has that changed since the festival's taken shape?
Yes. Well, you know, we have over 40 events and with our community partners, really thinking about different ways that we can approach this idea of wellness. So we have lectures and topics that really feature on how creators, individual creators, think about this concept. We have thinking about how do we narrate our own histories around illness and health, and how do we look to the future. So, you know, we were just you were just previewing the conversation about maternal health and wellness. When we think about that, that's usually told through a kind of quantitative space about, you know, the numbers, which is so important. But I think what this festival does is really help us to think about wellness from the inside out. Mm-hmm. So thinking about these ideas of what constitutes a good life, what is truth with a small t, what does it mean to be human? So that kind of, you know, moving from the inside out to think about these concepts, it's really broadened my understanding of wellness and health.
It's one of those things where people hear a wellness industry and they could be skeptical. Are there some perceptions or misconceptions out there that you want to address through the festival?
Yes, I thank you so much for that question. Wellness has become a very kind of, popular topic. But when we look at our programming, we see people really thinking about it in its historical context, thinking about the kind of the things that we don't often talk about. So the environment, we think about like these broader categories. And, you know, how do we relate to our food production? We have some films that deal with that. How do we think about, you know, people that have been excluded when we think about this broader category of wellness? So I think that the festival really delves into some really uncomfortable ways that this idea of wellness equals a kind of a particular individual wellness, and really focus on this larger, the social body, the collective body.
We will touch on some of the events being offered this year, but let me bring David into the conversation now. Dr. Fakunle, your event, The Lion Side, the Utilization of Storytelling for Transformation in Arts, Culture, and Health. Can you talk a little bit about how you've merged your specializations of public health, race, and storytelling?
My whole life has, I think, led to this moment where I get to, I think, utilize as close to my full potential as possible. And growing up in the moment, being a child, being a teenager, being a young adult, it didn't quite make sense. When I got to graduate school at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, that was the first opportunity for me to even consider the use of storytelling in particular in a public health context. And so much about innovation and creativity, whether we want to admit it or not, is about permission. And I, as a young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed grad student who thought the only path to success was, you know, hardcore epidemiology, got permission to consider something else, to consider a different pathway for impact in public health. And it took me back to the art form that I had been cultivating since I was 9 years old. I could have never predicted that. You know, so much of research is about prediction and figuring out likelihood. There's no equation that would have calculated this. And that's really what the essence of storytelling is. It's about elevating context. It's about inviting the people who we are charged to serve in health and wellness and medicine to provide their insight and their wisdom, because that is the critical information that we are missing when it comes to having not just efficacious health work, but efficient, impactful, meaningful health work. So for me, the opportunities such as this one to tell the story, to develop the story, to develop the research, to teach the classes, it's all about the relationships that I've been so blessed to cultivate. And any innovation, again, any advancement or evolution of this field, again, whether we want to admit it or not, mm-hmm. is built on the relationships and the opportunities for people to believe in us even before they believe in the innovation. And that is one of the core foundations of my story when it comes to merging my context as being a Black man, the African oral tradition that I proudly represent, and making advancements in the public health field, which I also love.
I had not told the audience that you're also the co-founder and CEO of Discover Me, Recover Me. That's an organization utilizing the African oral tradition to empower use of storytelling for healing and growth. How does that tradition fit into this concept of wellness?
I'm sure we're all familiar with the phrase, get something off your chest. I got to get it off my chest. That is, I would say, a very colloquial way of acknowledging psychophysiology. When we are able to express ourselves freely, honestly, without fear of manipulation, without fear of awkwardness, without fear of, without fear, best way for me to put it. But when we are there, it releases a lot within us. And so many of us are carrying around trauma and grief and pain and confusion. These are very human experiences that every single one of us possesses. So having the opportunity to even tell that story without looking for a solution, looking for an opinion, a recommendation, just having space to tell the story is healing in itself. And then if we couple that space for telling a story with a reminder of who you are as a human being. So this really gets into the flourishing, right? We're not just focusing on the challenges that people face. We're focusing on the assets and strengths that they bring simply by being themselves. So in our space, we call it virtues. It goes by many other names. So Rick, if I acknowledge your diligence in preparing for this interview, if I acknowledge the persistence with making sure we got here on time, right? If I acknowledge the humility with letting us tell our story, those are aspects of you, Rick, that are part of your humanity. And what is stopping us from elevating, acknowledging, strengthening those qualities so that it becomes a bigger part of your foundation for healing, for flourishing, for optimal health? And storytelling allows us to do that. It's a step. It's not the only part, but it's a good first step.
Big step, yeah. Are those virtues what you hope to convey to people who are attending the Lions Side event?
If I accomplish nothing else with this keynote, I hope that I remind my audience that they're human and that those conversations that we have by ourselves where we feel like, am I the only one? The answer is no. We share so many common denominators in this thing called life, and that should always be the critical foundation of anything we do. I don't care what profession you're in, let alone health and well-being. We're human, we're finite, we have a due date. What do we want this existence to mean? And so I want my audience to be grounded in the ultimate sense. And then building on top of that, I want them to see the value and utility of storytelling. I want them to see it as another pillar in how they assure the best health and well-being for those that they serve. It's low cost, it's low tech, it's easily accessible, and all it requires is trust and time. But there's so much critical information, so much valuable data that you'll get that ultimately can help people live better lives. And it can be done in collaboration with them. And I think that's the really beautiful part of this. We're helping each other. And again, I think that's a damn good strategy, pardon my language, a damn good strategy to bring into a world that has so many challenges to address.
Oh, we do have challenges. Thank you, David. Don't go anywhere. I wanted to move on and bring Rachel into the conversation as well, too. Before we get to what your specific event will be about, Rachel, how does your own personal story contribute to this career of yours as a financial wellness coach?
Yeah, thanks for that. I do so much relate to the storytelling, and that is so incredibly impactful, and I have a big passion for folks telling their story, so I'm glad that that has been already talked about. We all have a story generally, but I also think we all have a money story. And I think that so many of us are so afraid to talk about money. It is such a taboo topic still. And it's such a shame because there is a good chance that on a daily basis, every person is interacting with money on some type of a level. And yet we're all around there not talking about it. And so we're feeling like we're alone. And we're not alone. So my story, you know, I grew up in an environment where money was certainly not fluid. It was a big struggle. We struggled a lot. We qualified for assistance, and money was certainly not there when I wanted to go do the things I wanted to do as a child. And that, you know, it certainly taught me some positive things, like the value of a dollar and the importance of not having debt and, you know, like keeping that low. But it also taught me to be really stressed and anxious around money. And it taught me to be afraid that it was just going to go away at any second. And so I grew up with really that sort of poverty mindset of being terrified and hoarding my money and never wanting to spend it and being extremely stressed anytime I did have to spend money. And so, you know, it's certainly some good and bad that come with that. But it took me many, many years to go through my own money story and to understand why I was responding the way I was to money. And so I just think it's important that people share their story, because until you share it yourself, then you're recognizing why you're responding that way to money. And there's a good chance other people will be able to relate to that.
I think a lot of us have had times where the stress of money plays into our overall illness, wellness. What about financial literacy, though, Rachel? How much do you focus on just educating folks on the decisions financially that they'll make later in life?
Yes, a huge part of what I do is financial literacy. Unfortunately, it is not well taught in schools. I think we're getting a little better, but there's still so much stuff that is not taught. And I do a lot of presentations to adults that are professionals. And every time I leave there, they all say, wow, I learned so much. Like, I didn't know all of those details about, you know, some credit scores and reports and just like interest rates and things that are like things that we deal with that we're just not taught about. So education is a huge piece of what I do.
In 2021, you began something called Effortless Budgeting. You work with couples as well as individuals. What kind of issues do you see coming up, especially with couples? How do you help address them in terms of wellness?
Yeah, I would say when it comes to couples, a lot of what I see is them having different goals and different motivations, and they're not talking about it. So I think we all hear that finances are the number one reason for sort of breakups and arguments, but I actually push back on that and say it's the lack of communication around money that is really causing those arguments and those tensions in relationships. And so oftentimes what I see is one side of the couple has these motivations that are just very different from the other side. And they might actually have very similar goals, but their motivations are very different. So they're coming at it in a different way. And because they're not talking about it with each other, they're feeling a lot of tension and they're not understanding where the other person is coming from. And so when I'm meeting with them, I'm just trying to bring that out and help them understand each other.
If you have questions for Michelle Tracy Berger, David Fukunle, or Rachel Dorsey, 866-578-0903, the number to call. David, Rachel mentioned how your work can help her. Are there elements in this Humanities Festival for you with how the wellness is conceptualized that you could incorporate into your work?
Rachel is preaching to the choir, really, really are, because you're right. People are so afraid of money because they don't understand it. That's one of the conversations, I think, the practical conversations that we have to ourselves, right? Because money in just our own economy, for many people, defines a big part of who they are, right? They don't feel whole if they're not making X amount of dollars. And I've been a victim of that. I'm trying to break out of it, but I understand. When it comes to addressing holistic health, and that means addressing the whole person, certainly the physical makes a lot of sense, right? The mental and the emotional, even the spiritual, has its value. The financial and the economic are critical because until there is a major economic shakeup, I don't know when it will happen, if it will happen, money's going to make the world go around for a while. So, you know, you might as well get very, very comfortable with it. And one of the projects that we've been doing through another organization I'm part of, One Word Productions, we've been bringing arts and culture, we've been bringing physical health, we've been bringing spiritual and emotional health, as well as financial health, into this one effort to do our best to bring holistic healing when it comes to manifestations of trauma. And one of the things I'm so excited about with this upcoming year is that we're going to really be building on the financial and economic health. I still remember learning how to write checks in like fifth grade. I don't know where that came from, but I think that was the only exposure to financial and economic health that I had in an educational setting. So, and that was 20 plus years ago. So it is definitely lacking, and there's much more sophistication that needs to be provided because it makes such a huge difference. Knowing you can pay the bills relieves a lot of stress. I think we can all relate to that. Being able to take care of the needs and even some of the wants just makes you feel so much better on a daily, weekly, and yearly basis. Mm-hmm. And the part that I know Rachel will certainly understand, and one of the things that I'm so grateful I learned, it doesn't take much. It just takes consistency with anything, losing weight, you know, being able to tell your story, building wealth. It takes consistency. And that's something that is within everyone's capability. And yet we need to understand what may prevent people from being able to activate that consistency or activate the resources to utilize that consistency, and stories help with that.
Yeah, there are so many people, you're right, who just don't have an idea how the financial system works. I can remember when my son went to college, one of his freshman roommates kept all of his money in cash in a drawer because he had no idea how the banking system worked, how to write a check, that kind of thing. Thank you for that. Michelle, I wanted to get back to you and mention some of the other events happening this year at the festival. One of those is someone our listeners will likely be familiar with, Lisa D'Amore, recent guest on the program, talking about her new book, The Emotional Lives of Teenagers. Always engaging with her, especially coming out of the pandemic and the issues we see with social media.
Absolutely. And I just want to anchor really what we've been talking about, these big questions that really go through every aspect of our lives, right? So financial wellness, thinking about how we show up as, you know, to tell our stories, to also deal with the legacies of trauma. I think these are just really important in our events. I just wanted to, for those who might not know, all of our events at the Baker Nord Center collaborates with and sponsors are free to the public. And we have so many events that people can, I think, kind of touch on in terms of their own interests. But yes, we're really excited about Lisa D'Amore. She's going to be talking about her recent book, The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, and making the argument that it's really about helping teenagers manage their feelings. So it's not about always being good or calm or relaxed, but really thinking about how can we support young people to be able to learn how to think about and talk about their emotions in a different way. So I think that's going to be really a great place for people to kind of check in about those kinds of issues. And she's a faculty member at CASE. I'd love to talk about some of our other events if I can.
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to ask you about Cassandra Lane because I know that I think you're interviewing her, right?
I am. And so Cassandra Lane is a managing editor of LA Parent, and she wrote a fabulous, amazing, and just wonderful memoir called We Are Bridges. And her great-grandfather on her mother's side was lynched. And everyone in the family knew that had happened, but no one really was dealing with the underlying issues. No one really wanted to talk about it. And so the book, We Are Bridges, her memoir, goes on a journey, takes the reader on a journey about her own understanding of how this trauma impacted her family. But also in the memoir, she really beautifully tries to recreate the life of her great-grandfather and also the life of her great-grandmother, and does some interesting narrative things in that memoir. So I'm in conversation with her. The title of our talk is going to be Navigating Family Secrets and Healing Intergenerational Trauma. When we're collaborating with the Cleveland Public Library, I'm really excited about this conversation because it's about how do we deal with these challenges that our families face, that are collective challenges, and how do then we talk to other people about it. Really excited about that. I hope people come out and join us for that.
One more quickly. I know you're doing a poetry event at the Wick Poetry Center at Kent State. What We Learned While Alone, Global Voices Speak to the Pandemic. What's this involve?
Oh my goodness, we're so excited about this. This is a multimedia performance, and it's based on the Global Vaccine Poem Project, which was a collaboration between the Wick Poetry Center at Kent State University and the University of Arizona. And so they developed an anthology with contributions from all around the world, poetry that people were writing in relation to sharing their responses about the pandemic. And they adapted that for theatrical production. And so this is going to be an amazing multimedia performance. And they're also going to be asking the audience to respond through their phones. And there's going to be this great kind of prompts that the audience is given. And there's going to be poetry and, theater performance. And so really, we're very, very excited about this. So if you are someone who wants to be kind of engaged with these questions about what did we learn during the pandemic, that's going to be a great event for folks.
David Fukunley, I know you focus on the oral, but that act she's talking about, writing, creating poetry, processing emotions, interacting with people, is that something you fold into your work as well?
Absolutely, because poetry is storytelling, dancing is storytelling, singing is storytelling. All those things take time. They take exploration. They take trust. They take that leap of faith going into your vulnerabilities. I would think we would all say some of the best art and best culture really reflects vulnerability, but a freedom when you get to express your true selves. So again, the creating space is just that, taking the time that people need to gather their thoughts and their feelings, because both of those components are critical elements of storytelling. So it really is about embracing the whole human, something that we all do to some various degrees. And there's something special about when we do it together. We feel closer. We feel understood. We feel loved. Mm-hmm. And those things mean everything.
Thank you. Rachel Dorsey, your event is How to Build a Healthy Financial Life. It's April 13th at the Parma Heights branch of the Cuyahoga County Public Library. What do you want people to take away from that?
Really, my whole goal is to help people be more comfortable and confident with their finances. So I want them to leave with some education so that empowers them to make the best financial decisions for themselves.
Thank you so much for being here today, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. David Fukunley speaking March 17th at 4:15. His event's titled The Lion's Side, Utilization of Storytelling for Transformation in Arts, Culture, and Health. Thank you for being here and your conversation today. Good luck with the event.
Thank you so much, Cleveland. See you soon.
See you soon. And Dr. Michelle Tracy Berger, Director of Case Western Reserve University's Baker Nord Center for the Humanities. Good luck with the festival.
Oh, thank you so much. And we're so excited. Can't wait to see people at our events.
Can't wait to see folks out there. Thank you so much, all of you. We're going to take a short break right now, but on the other side, we will preview a film screening and panel event hosted by MetroHealth and the Creating Healthier Communities organization. It's raising awareness about maternal and infant mortality for Black women and babies here and across the United States. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We're back in a minute. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. 3.5 years ago, 30-year-old Shamani Gibson died 13 days after giving birth to her son due to complications from childbirth. This morning, a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that the national maternal death rate among Black Americans is much higher than other racial groups. In 2021, it was 69.9 for every 100,000 births. That's 2.6 times higher than the rate for white women. Locally, Cuyahoga County has one of the highest rates of maternal and infant mortality in the country for Black women and babies, that according to the Ohio Department of Health. Now compare that to a nation like Australia, where the death rate was 2. The documentary Aftershock, now streaming on Hulu, follows family members who are left to process what many health experts say are preventable deaths. Here's Shamani's mother, Shawnee Benton Gibson, from the documentary.
My daughter's birthday, she would have been 31 years old today, and she loved to plan things and to party, so we're having this celebration on her behalf. This is a celebration of life, but also it's about how Shamani has been speaking to all of us in our family and extended community since she passed.
Monday, starting at 4:30, the MetroHealth System and a national nonprofit, Creating Healthier Communities, will be hosting a free screening of Aftershock at the Huntington Convention Center of Cleveland. Afterwards, a panel will discuss the maternal and infant mortality crisis nationally and locally. Attendees will be given the opportunity to take part in meditation, movement, and other healing practices. Now, joining us to preview this event, talk more about the issues being brought up in the documentary, are two of the panelists for Monday's event. Shawnee Benton Gibson, co-founder and CEO, Spirit of a Woman, whom I mentioned earlier, the mother of Shamani Gibson. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. Also with us, Dr. Heather Rice, assistant professor in the School of Nursing at Cleveland State University. Thank you, doctor, for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me this morning.
If you have questions about maternal or infant mortality crisis in Northeast Ohio, give us a call right now, 866-578-0903. You can email thoughts to SOI at ideastream.org. You can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Shawnee, first, of course, you have our condolences. But for those who haven't seen this powerful documentary, a winner at Sundance, by the way, can you please share some memories of your daughter?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for starting here. Because that's paramount, that she lived, I think it's 11,248 days on the planet, and then she transitioned one day And we don't want that day to have the victory over who she was and, you know, how she was in the world. So Shamani was a fiery spirit, very, very active in community, very involved with the maternal health crisis because of my work that I was doing for 12 years before she transitioned, which made the loss like really, really devastating because she knew what to do. She had a doula, midwife, she exercised, she ate well, she's very active in her research because that's the type of person that she was, just very committed to making sure that she was conscious of the things that were necessary for her health and well-being. She was an artist, had two businesses. She did hair, and she also had a company called Artful Living and would engage in community transformation through art as edutainment. And, you know, I just heard you talking about art with someone else, just a powerful medium for teaching and transforming community. And she was committed to making sure that she did that and also pursuing her desires and dreams to be a financial advisor for those who were in entrepreneurship so they could win in their goals and directives for business. So just an awesome daughter, my firstborn, and taught me a lot about how to be a mother and how to be a person in the world. So losing her was devastating on so many different levels. That's why we say that the title of the film, Aftershock, is so apropos because the ripple effects of her loss and so many others like her can still be felt.
Because of the person she was and the knowledge she had and the fact that you work in the healthcare industry had to be even a bigger shock for you, her partner, her sister, the rest of the family. But you said in the film her death was entirely preventable.
Absolutely. They have recently done research, and Dr. Rice can probably amplify this. I believe the stats are 85% of the deaths, these losses are preventable when it comes to Black and Brown folk. And if you're Native, you know, First Nation people, it's 90%. So when you hear that, it hits you at the gut, or should, because these deaths should not have happened. And simple things like just listening to someone when they share that they're in pain, or when they say that they can't breathe, or that they're struggling with their emotional state of being. And we'll talk more, I'm sure, in this interview about why BIPOC, or Black Indigenous people of color in particular, are in danger in this country and abroad because of systemic racism and bias and oppression. But yeah, these deaths are definitely, we can stop them if we all just listen and do our part across sectors, and especially in the healthcare industry.
Yeah, the film points out, looking back 100 plus years ago, saying that doctors would experiment on Black women, saying, quote, the Negro women don't feel pain. And that's the kind of thing you say, Shawnee, is still kind of out there in some medical facilities where people don't treat Black women the same as they treat others.
Oh, absolutely. They've done research. And I always say this, you know, don't listen to what I'm sharing or what Dr. Rice might share. Actually do your own research. My cousin, who was there with Shamani when she transitioned at the hospital that she died in Brooklyn, you know, she shared as a clinician that's been in the field for many, many years that her colleagues to this day talk about the myth, the ridiculousness about how Black and Brown women feel pain, and that our skin is different and we are wired differently and we can process pain and deal with pain differently than our white counterparts. And that fallacy is causing lives to be lost. Also, the belief that if we're saying we're in pain, we're exaggerating our pain and we're drug seeking. So there's lots of layers to it. But yeah, definitely that there are brilliant people believing these ridiculous, ignorant things, and it's costing people their lives.
Heather, are what she just called ridiculous, ignorant things also driving the maternal mortality crisis here in Cuyahoga County?
Absolutely. We continue to see, even to this day, medical students that have these beliefs that there is a difference in the way in which African Americans experience pain from other cultures, and we know that not to be true. So we're just continuing to address how people are being trained and how they are going about communicating and connecting and building trust and relationship with their patients so that they're able to actually address the concerns that they state that they're having in these appointments.
As we don't argue that there is a racial disparity, as we look at why there's a racial disparity, we notice it's not just due to socioeconomic lines. We can all remember a couple of years ago, tennis great Serena Williams talking about her doctors not believing her pregnancy-related health issues. Heather, why do we just not hear what women are saying?
Well, I think it goes back a lot to a lot of the racial issues that we know still persist in our country, and issues specifically around African-American women, and knowing African women know their bodies, they know their pain, they are able to speak up when they have concerns, and addressing those implicit biases and continued forms of medical racism that still exist in our institutions, being able to truly know that your patient can speak for themselves and the things that they're experiencing. So if you're not attuned with that and you're a provider, you absolutely may miss that because of your own biases that you have for the person that you're caring for.
I'm sure you were not surprised by the CDC report that came out this morning, kind of highlighting some of the numbers. Do we know what we can do to decrease the maternal mortality rate? I'm not just talking Cuyahoga County, but everywhere. Is it something we know and we just aren't doing, or is it something else?
We absolutely have amazing interventions that can be utilized. One in particular is ensuring that African-American women are paired with a doula when they're going through labor so that they have support. We have those services here in Cleveland, Ohio, through Birth and Beautiful Communities. We also know that Black women tend to have better outcomes when there is racial concordance, so making sure that their providers look like them. And we also in the city of Cleveland have Village of Healing Center, which is a African-American midwife that provides services for African-American women. So ensuring that our women understand what's available to them, what the data suggests, and ensuring that they're connected to those resources when they're going through pregnancy and the postpartum period.
The film pointing out that those are some of the things that weren't available in the Bronx at the time that the women in the feature were talking or were giving birth. Shawnee, talk about your goal of sharing your story in the documentary. What do you want me, what do you want other people to take away from this?
The biggest thing that I would like to declare is that this is a global crisis, and we're all responsible and accountable for making sure that the youngest members of our community make it earthside, from the womb to the world. Is just really important, and I view this as an existential crisis. So if a Black woman or a brown woman, indigenous woman, cannot trust that she will be cared for, they will be cared for and covered during this critical rite of passage in this time where they're most vulnerable, then anybody else who identifies as human on this planet is also in jeopardy of having this happen. I want to reiterate for those listeners who do not identify as BIPOC that there's a crisis in reproductive health for everyone. It's just that Black women and brown women are more likely to experience near death or fatal outcomes giving birth. So if we transform the state of affairs for BIPOC women and birthing people and their babies, then we also create a safer space for pregnancy, labor delivery, and postpartum for all. So it's important to just recognize that. The other piece that I want to share is that, you know, there's a lot of controversy about talking about race in this country. You know, the bottom line is that this country was founded on racist bias, racist practice, belief systems, and structures. And that doesn't change and transform overnight. So taking responsibility for our history and what has happened, and you named early, and I thank you for sharing that, you know, Black women were experimented on so that we could have the reproductive system that we have now. And that's Betsy, Anarka, and Lucy, whose names we actually know, but there were so many others, that if we do not recognize that history is an important piece for transforming what's happening in the here and now and for the future, then we're doomed to wipe ourselves out as a culture and as a human species. And I'm so serious about that. If we can't birth safely, then we're not going to survive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for underscoring that point, that it's not just Black women, it's everybody. It's just more particularly hard-hitting in the Black community. So you were in healthcare, and then this tragedy happens to you, your family, and friends. What made you want to turn your grief into activism?
And I want to clarify that Shimani passed away in Brooklyn, and Amber Isaac, who's also in the Aftershock documentary.
She was Bronx, right?
She transitioned in the Bronx. You know, but I love that you brought it up, because Amber's borough, because I'm in New York, is just as, and what happens there is just as important as what happens in Brooklyn or Queens or any borough here in New York and in any region or space that exists across the country and abroad. I am a licensed psychotherapist, so I've been in the field for over 32 years. And so what I want to reiterate is the importance of looking at the medical or the physical health issues that contribute to the passing of a Black and brown person or any person, but also there's a piece that doesn't get as much attention, which is postpartum depression and psychosis or perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. And so me as a clinician in the field and also as a coach, an activist and an advocate and a person who's a stand for Black and brown women getting what they need, I entered into the space of advocacy and activism before Shamani died. And like you mentioned earlier, it hit hard because it's like I'm doing all of this work and still my daughter passed away. And I mentioned it in the film, but it's not enough to know these things. Knowledge will not save you. What is needed is the system joining me and others at our knowledge so that we can elevate the outcomes and make sure that everybody survives and thrives doing the most natural thing that one can do, which is bring new life into the world.
Thank you. Dr. Rice, I gave the national numbers earlier. Could you give us some numbers for Cuyahoga County in terms of what we're looking at in infant mortality?
Absolutely. Here in Cuyahoga County, African-American women continue to experience greater disparities compared to Caucasian women at 3 to 4 times the risk. And also that number persists and affects our infants. So African-American infants account for 37% of our births, but 73% of our deaths here in Cuyahoga County. So when we're looking at those numbers and we're thinking about the fact that this is for preventable reasons and being in a city where there are world-class medical institutions, we really have to look at what else is going on and how we can continue to support our families to make sure that their children are born safely and have the best and most optimal opportunities once they are here to do well and survive and really thrive here in this county.
Feel free to go ahead and name some of those resources.
Birthing Beautiful Communities is one resource where women can be paired with a doula to support them from when they find out that they're pregnant until their baby's first year of life. Village of Healing Center is offering medical services for women who are seeking a provider that looks like them, that has a midwife, that have that option. We also have Pregnant with Possibilities Resource Center that has social support that's available for moms. So Cleveland has excellent resources that are here, that are local, that are available to support specifically our African-American families.
Let's go to the phones right quick. Todd is on line one with a question for you. Todd, welcome back to Sound of Ideas.
Hey, Rick, Shawnee, Heather. I do have two questions. I want to make two comments since I heard them while I was on hold. The country was actually founded on classism, not racism. And I wanted to ask Heather and Shawnee, to the best of your knowledge, is there any information that's factual that's been put out there as to what degree any of those maternal deaths are caused primarily because they didn't prepare themselves correctly prior to conception to be pregnant, to deliver, and get good clarity on the understanding of what it's going to take in general for their body to bounce back and them in the specific?
Heather, take this one. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Because we see that this problem persists across socioeconomic statuses, I'm not going to put that blame on the African-American woman specifically, because we can see if that issue persists regardless of your access to care and your educational attainment, then that begins to suggest that there are other things regarding your structural systems that may be leading those poor outcomes. So I would say that there's much more that's going on in maternal health. We actually know that the data does not suggest that people are not engaging in prenatal care. A lot of women are healthy and doing well prior to their pregnancy. Even the women that are mentioned in this documentary speak about that, that they weren't people who came into their pregnancy with a lot of health risk, but that there are instances of where they're expressing concerns and things are not being addressed and ignored. So when we have instances where things are preventable and it's for preventable health complications, then we have to begin to look back at our providers as well as the system in which they were receiving the care, because it's being happened for things that are being missed. So I think that that's important to highlight, that it's not an issue specifically on the woman's lack of preparation, but more so that once they are becoming pregnant and they are connecting to the systems, that they're falling in between the cracks and things are being missed and ignored, unfortunately.
Thank you. Shawnee, one of the things I saw in the film was you talk about the impact of men and how many men there are who are now left as single parents because of this situation.
Yeah, and actually I'm glad that the brother spoke just before you asked this question. I think it's so important for those who are privileged to be embodied as males, that they recognize what impact that has when there is a declaration of there being fault or projection onto the folks that are impacted by this scourge or these scourges of maternal morbidity and mortality in this country. I also want to point out, and I say it all the time, that the three, the triplets, I call them, that impact these outcomes are white supremacy culture, patriarchy, and capitalism. And, you know, when those three coalesce and they synergize, it creates danger for all of us, but specifically those who identify as BIPOC. And there's research to back up that there is something about the foundations of racism and oppression that impact Black and brown folks across issues around their medical care and their mental health care. And there's something that's called weathering that they've done research on, and I encourage the audience to look it up. Once again, don't take my word for it. Weathering is the toll that it takes to be Black or brown in this country, the oppression, the underemployment, the unemployment, just all of the layers that we don't project and make and cause blame or project blame on the folks that are impacted are impacting outcomes in reference to our pregnancies and our labor and delivery. That epigenetics means the trauma that we've experienced across generations impacts our well-being. So you can want to be well and do the best that you can, like my daughter and Amber were, who died, and still, because of these systems and because of just what happens with our bodies, we end up in danger. And the brothers that you mentioned, I'll say this really quickly because I know we don't have a lot of time. My son in love and Bruce McIntyre are committed to making sure that their voices as men who are about anti-oppression, especially as far as patriarchy, are in the conversation, not trying to dominate, but co-create with women and birthing people to keep this from happening. Imagine a world where partners that identify as men are just as versed on what happens to a woman's body and when she's laboring and delivering and postpartum, when she's most likely, if she's Black and brown, to die from complications. Imagine if a man knew the language and knew what to look for and spoke up and advocated for their partner and followed up and checked in around their postpartum journeys.
It would be better. Thank you so much, Shawnee. We're going to have to cut it short for time there, but thank you so much. Shawnee Benton-Gibson, CEO and co-founder of Spirit of Woman. Dr. Heather Rice was also with us, assistant professor at the School of Nursing at Cleveland State. Thank you both. The event they were talking about starts at 4:30 on Monday, takes place at the Huntington Convention Center of Cleveland. We'll be right back in a second. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us on this day. Did you know that there was a part of Akron that's called Old Dublin, a shantytown for Irish immigrants? Mostly forgotten today, but IdeaStream Public Media's Kabir Bhatia filed this as part of his Oh Really series. It starts with Irish immigrant Mary Donahue of North Canton reading from an 1892 history of Akron.
The lower lands of what is now called North Akron, being thickly dotted over the log and slab shanties, inhabited mostly by Irish labourers upon the canal, was christened and for many years retained the historic name of Dublin.
There's a spot just north of downtown, right next to the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railway Depot, where one can look down the hill at the Little Cuyahoga River. It's where I found myself on a rainy afternoon with Akron attorney Chris Esker.
The Irish roots would be my grandfather, whose last name was Horgan. And his name was Dennis, his father's name was Dennis, his father's name was Dennis, but it was his father who had emigrated to the United States and ended up in upstate New York working for the railroad. We're standing under the Y Bridge right now, or the All-America Bridge.
Esker led me to this spot after seeing a social media post about what the area was called in the 1820s.
What happened to the idea of an old Dublin?
The shantytown was a working village for Irish laborers who built the Ohio and Erie Canal in the 1820s and 30s. It grew to more than 200 people. But University of Akron historian Eric Olson says much of Old Dublin's history was never documented.
Irish were not considered white as we think of them today. At that time, they were like discriminated against in ways that today we think would be weird because they're considered part of the same racial category. I'm not condoning any of this. This is obviously 19th century history that we're talking about here.
After the canal was finished, Old Dublin was essentially abandoned as the Irish moved to other parts of the city. But remnants of its history remained, as the hillside had been used as a makeshift cemetery.
It even being reported that a pretty well-preserved skull thus brought to the light was missing head of William Beatson, the Englishman murdered at Cuyahoga Falls in 1853.
His bones were discovered years later when what had been Old Dublin was being excavated for the Valley Railway and other purposes. And that's what led to people remembering that there had once been a shanty town there. Historian Eric Olson explains.
This is actually the bed of the Pennsylvania and Ohio Canal, which went defunct very quickly. So you had a canal splicing through this community. You have railroads that were built around the 1870s in this community as well.
Paddy built the railways amid the highways and dug canals. The Irish have prospered and moved into better city quarters, while the Italian, a latecomer, has taken old houses and become the predominating influence in the locality. The territory has been conquered in succession by Ireland, Africa, and Italy.
Old Dublin continued evolving into what's today the Cascade Valley neighborhood. A city report puts the current population at about 2,200 people, with a quarter of the homes being built this century. Standing next to the Little Cuyahoga, Chris Esker wonders what it was like 200 years ago.
Where the river is flowing, it would have been up the hillside, where Old Dublin would have been, and then kind of rolling its way down to the water, since people always gravitate toward water. So you and I can see where we were 5 minutes ago, which is just up the hill by the river tracks. And then, yeah, it would have been the rough and tumble down into the water area and where people would have done what they need to do by water. Clean, bathe, get water, whatever they needed.
Akron's history has been written and rewritten and rewritten. When you're doing historical stuff, it's the same way we learned to do research in law school. You do your research until you come back around to where you started.
Old Dublin may be gone, but there are still remnants of Irish heritage in Akron, from the ancient Order of Hibernians, which is a social club in Firestone Park, to St. Vincent St. Mary High School, and even the city's current mayor, Dan Horrigan. Kabir Bhatia, IdeaStream Public Media.
And you can learn more about Old Dublin and see some photos of the area at ideastream.org. You can also ask your question for Oh Really, the podcast which makes you part of the reporting process. Tomorrow in The Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable with Mike McIntyre. He'll be joined this week by IdeaStream's Gabriel Kramer, Ken Schneck from the Buckeye Flame, and Karen Kassler down at the State House News Bureau. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you again on Monday.